He said, we were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night.
I don't think cocked and loaded is a standard phrase, by the way.
It's definitely not. It's locked and
it's
loaded.
It's locked and loaded.
It is
cocked
definitely.
And loaded gets
it's
some
very much
interesting
a
results.
Freudian, it's a Freudian.
Interesting
sleep.
Result if you search for that.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The first Democratic primary debates are scheduled for later this week, but the candidates are already butting heads. So former Vice President Joe Biden's comments about his past work with segregationists in the Senate earned him some pretty strong pushback from Senator Cory Booker last week. And then Senator Bernie Sanders appeared to be taking a jab at Senator Elizabeth Warren when he tweeted an article about centrists coming around to her side. So today we're going to take a look at how much of the conflict in the primary is happening within particular lanes and whether those lanes are evident in the polling. At the start of the campaign, we talked about the lanes that each of the candidates were theoretically occupying, but we also questioned the extent to which those lanes were real or actually meaningful for voters. So we're going to get into that today. We're also going to key in specifically on Biden's comments about working with segregationists, how he's dealt with the blowback, and what the possible repercussions are. And here with me to do all of that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going, Nate?
It's going well, Galen. Thank you.
And senior politics writer Claire Malone. How are you?
Good.
And managing editor Micah Cohen, how's it going?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Later in the show, we are also going to discuss President Trump's stance on Iran and how Americans feel about potential conflict. But first, as I mentioned, let's zoom in on Biden's comments last week. He was at a fundraiser talking about being criticized by the new left for wanting to build consensus across party lines. As an example for how this could be done, he brought up his relationship with two segregationist senators. And this is what happened according to a press pool report written by Ken Thomas of the Wall Street Journal. Quote, I was in a caucus with James O. Eastland, Mr. Biden said briefly, channeling the late Mississippi Senator's Southern drawl. Mr. Biden said of Mr. Eastland, quote, he never called me boy, he always called me son. And then he went on to say about a deceased Georgia senator, a guy like Herman Talmadge, one of the meanest guys I ever knew. You go down the list of these guys, well, guess what? At least there was some civility. We got things done. We didn't agree on much of anything. We got things done. We got it finished. But today you look at the other side and you're the enemy, not the opposition, the enemy. We don't talk to each other anymore. Okay, so he said that these comments were taken out of context. What specifically are people reacting to in his comments, and has it been taken out of context?
I think that people are probably having the strongest reaction to the very off-color, I don't know if you call it a joke, but the thing he said about, he never called me boy, he always called me son. That's obviously a very racialized term when you're talking about, you know, whether or not a Southern segregationist senator would, you know, call a black or white man, you know, son or boy. That's just, Biden, I think, trod into territory he should not have trod into. I think the stuff about civility, I mean, it's interesting because it's become such a, if you follow political Twitter, the term civility has become almost a joke.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Biden is not operating on that political Twitter realm. And he was sort of trying to make the point, I think, that, listen, these people were my colleagues in the Senate in the 70s. I think he said one of them was like a disgusting guy or something to that effect, he said, but we still pass things together, which has sort of been the part that Congressional Black Caucus leaders have glommed onto, which is they're saying, listen, Joe Biden was colleagues with these people. He's been in the Senate for a long time and he still got stuff done. But I think that definitely the first part of his comments are what people are reacting
to.
Yeah.
What's been the overarching response to those comments?
I mean, I don't know if there's an overarching response, and this is a case where, so let me back up a bit, right? There is a history of Joe Biden saying things or doing things that people on Twitter tend to get very upset about and predict it's a big problem for his campaign, and then the poll comes out the next week and shows nobody has changed their mind about anything.
Are you saying that he's the Trump of the 2020 Democratic primary?
Okay, Galen. You know, but there is elements where, like, will he maintain the 31% of the electorate he has, where they're mostly older voters. Actually, there are a lot of African Americans in that group and so on and so forth. And so I'm not sure you can necessarily use like media Twitter as a good guide. It may even be a contrary indicator for how Biden stuff will occur. I mean, I wrote a little item last week saying this seems like the kind of thing where it touches on a lot of sensitivities. As Perry wrote in his piece, a lot of Democrats now are very concerned about racial justice.
But what has the reaction been, right? So like political Twitter, you said, reacted strongly. What about outside of political Twitter?
Well, it would be nice to have some polling data, and we don't have any yet as of this recording on late Monday morning. We do not have any polling showing how voters reacted.
Cory Booker certainly reacted.
Cory Booker reacted strongly, and Biden not only did not apologize to Booker, but said Cory should apologize to me and used his name Cory. There were a number of members of the Congressional Black Caucus who defended Biden. There were actually, maybe related, maybe not, a couple members of the CBC who endorsed Kamala Harris on the day this was all happening for Biden. You had, I think, one Biden staffer leave and make some noise about it, and you had some kind of backbiting in the press and stuff like that. I mean, look, for various reasons, ranging from the fact that he does have a number of vulnerabilities to the fact that he has a complicated record on stuff like racial busing, right? But also the fact that, you know, he's been the front runner for a long time. People are bored of that story. The fact that reporters and people who are influential in politics increasingly skew younger and more liberal, and so they will be happy to blow up controversies. I mean, I put it like this. There is a big appetite at this moment in time to find negative storylines about Joe Biden. But at the same time, this was, I think, a real mistake.
So you're not saying that that's what this is? Or you are saying that that's what this is?
I'm saying that, like, Hillary Clinton should have been more careful with their emails because it would have blown up a medium-sized mountain into, like, the Appalachians or something, right? And this is, I think, in the similar vein where, like...
Also a medium-sized mountain range.
Yeah, okay. No, a medium-sized mountain into a whole range of mountains.
Why?
I don't want to say the Rockies.
What?
A, never mind. But, but I do want to say one thing, though, which is, like, when you kind of read that original Wall Street Journal story and kind of recontextualize it for me, I kind of thought, oh, actually, in context, okay. It's a little different than the reaction you would get after chewing on it and seeing people's hot takes for a week.
I think... people should read Perry's piece.
Yeah.
Because, as Nate said, we don't have polling about how the public is reacting to this. But Perry makes a good point about, you know, Biden is leading with black voters far and away. And yeah, this could have an effect. But Perry also has this, I think, very good, insightful line in the piece where he talks about, you know, talking to voters and talking to other reporters who've talked to black voters. They say that one of the reasons why they like Biden is in part because of the fact that he has like this more old-fashioned approach to talking about race and working with Republicans, that black voters see him as having more appeal to white voters and therefore having an appeal electability-wise. In other words, that he would still be the strongest electoral candidate in part because of his antiquated for Twitter approach to these issues.
Right. Like black voters, of course, are also weighing candidates' electabilities when they're making their choices, just like everybody else is.
Right. And I think it's something along the lines of, listen, 08 and 12 were an anomaly. And you know, this is the logic of a black voter who's supporting Biden. They'll say 08 and 12 were an anomaly when we, you know, elected a black president. America has elected a person who has been race baiting, made racist comments. Maybe we need kind of a person who can be the middle ground and talk the way white voters might talk amongst each other, right? That's kind of like the reason that Perry goes through.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there was kind of a strain in the coverage of these remarks originally that underlying it was like, oh, Biden is doing really well among black voters. This could hurt him among black voters because it's about a racial issue. And I think what Perry walks through is like, it doesn't really work like that. First of all, white Democrats have grown increasingly liberal and rate racial issues increasingly high in terms of how they're prioritizing their issues. And also black voters, as you guys were just saying, care about electability and have a whole set of issues they're looking at like any other voter. The other thing though is like, look, whether this affects his standing in the polls or not, I'm not sure. You know, it sort of breaks down along the people who I think will be most upset by this. So let's say college-educated white liberals, to oversimplify, and let's say younger black voters aren't in Biden's camp anyway to begin with. So maybe it doesn't hurt him that much. But to me, and I'm not sure that's true, but to me, this is indicative of the kind of fundamental question at the heart of Biden's candidacy, which is like gets at what Claire was saying, which is like, can a candidate who frankly feels more from like the mid-2000s or even the late 90s win in this modern Democratic Party. Even the way he, first of all, this all arose because Biden was responding to pushback on comments he made that he could work with Republicans,
right?
And Democrats were like, bullshit, that's not going to happen. And then even his response of like, oh, I don't have a racist bone in my body, is like an understanding of racism that I think kind of feels a little outdated.
Once again, the rhetoric that he's using is rhetoric that I think political reporters or like see as outmoded. Not a racist bone in my body. Civility, right? These are things that people are kind of taught to, you know, it's like your eighth grade English teacher saying, don't use that word so much.
Yeah.
And people, I think people are very much, they react to Biden's even use of specific words to describe his feelings because they do feel, we talked about this a lot in 2016, that Trump called out people's generic political phrases, right? You know, he remember he called out Marco Rubio for sort of being like a robot. Or was that?
That
Chris
was Christie.
Well,
yeah,
anyway,
Christie,
2016 did a lot of that. Like, we see what you're doing. We know what that is. And we're calling it out. And that's a little bit what I think the Biden rhetoric felt like, his sort of response to it immediately.
And just in case listeners are looking for it, the article that we've been talking about from our colleague Perry Bacon Jr. is called How Will Biden's Latest Comments Affect His Standing in the Democratic Party? And he lays out various different statistics, including that he's getting more than 55% of the Democratic primary vote among black voters over the age of 45, compared to 35% among blacks under the age of 45. So very strong over 45, and still like relatively strong as you get younger. And he also lays out, for example, as you were mentioning, Micah, that white Democrats in general increasingly have like very liberal views on race. According to Pew, a higher percentage of white Democrats, 78%, than black Democrats, 71%, said that being white helps a person get ahead in America today. So those views of white Democrats have evolved a lot, of course, since Joe Biden was in the Senate working with segregationists, or even when he was in the Senate in the 90s, work on the crime bill, for example. And maybe this gets into a little bit of what you were talking about his style and who he appeals to begin with. Part of the story is Joe Biden not apologizing. Why did he make that calculation?
Well, that's sort of a campaign strategy so far.
Yeah, it feels like they've made kind of a meta decision that the kind of bar for them explicitly apologizing is going to be very high during this campaign.
Because he's had, I think the internal logic is he's been in politics for 40 years. He's been like a middle of the road Democrat for all of those years. And the Democratic Party has obviously gotten a lot more liberal. So I think that that's sort of,
I think it's smart. I think when you apologize, you kind of, well, it depends on how you apologize.
You like formalize it
legitimize these critiques, right? And yeah, I think if you don't want to actually show that like that you're wounded, I think there is something to be said for that. I mean, we should make one distinction, which is like Biden right now has about 30% of the vote. And I think there's maybe a pretty decent chance that that 30% won't be swayed by this. There is another 70%, and there's some evidence that his favorability ratings have gone down, although they're still pretty good with the other 70%. And 30% is not quite enough to win on its own, given that Democrats don't have any winner-take-all rules, meaning that, you know, you really have to improve that 30%. And if he's at 30% and Warren's at 20 and Harris is at 20 and Mayor Pete is at 15 or Bernie's somewhere in there.
What was the name we came up with?
Pedo Klobuchar?
Pedo Buttigieg.
Pedo Buttigieg.
Yeah.
But if he seems like he's running a factional campaign, then that's dangerous to him. It's the same reason why I'm pretty skeptical of Bernie Sanders' chances, is because he is definitely running a factional campaign, although he is 15% and not 30. 30 might almost work. But can Biden be the representative of the Democratic Party consensus? Then stuff like this might make it harder.
Do you think Biden, in a more holistic way, Biden has this really long record, as Claire mentioned, that now feels out of step with where the Democratic Party is? You know, the busing thing, of course, but like even to the crime bill, even on abortion, you know, he just flipped on the Hyde Amendment. But I wonder if he's going to have to kind of keep doing this throughout the campaign, and if he should be like, you know, listen, I've been in office for decades. A bunch of stuff I did doesn't reflect who I am now. Here's who I am now.
I'm really interested to see how he handles it in the debate.
In the debate, yeah.
He has run a more almost like he's running this from the White House kind of campaign. And I think that's we've talked about this a little bit. He doesn't have to introduce himself to the world. So he does spend a lot more days meeting with advisors or doing sort of more private press events that don't have like the public rally feel. So the debate does have a bit of the valence of there's been a lot of stuff that you've been reading about me in the press lately. Here I am. Here's what it is.
But see, I wonder if so they probably figured everybody knows who Joe Biden is. I don't have to introduce myself. The Biden campaign has not released a bunch of policy proposals in the way that Warren or a bunch of other candidates have. I've wondered if they've miscalculated there, because in the absence of that, what is the media looking at? It's looking at this long record, which in many cases is now out of step. Now, all that said, maybe the campaign is like, hey, first debate, we'll start kind of unveiling this. And the first debate
had a bunch of stuff on immigration.
They had a thing today in the, I think it was in the Miami Herald, he wrote an op-ed about his immigration plans. But I'm sure I think that's probably purposefully hooked to debate week.
To the debate. They haven't answered a bunch of policy questions from a bunch of media outlets. Biden, compared to most of the other candidates, has been a relatively black box in terms of what policies he's putting forth.
I want to move on to our next conversation, which is about lanes within the Democratic primary. But before we do that, there's a part of the conversation about Biden that gets at that theme, right? Which is that one of the strongest reactions was from Senator Cory Booker. What was going on? What was the dynamic between Booker and Biden last week?
It was super interesting. I mean, Booker's statement was direct and pretty strong. You know, he said, quote, "You don't joke about calling black men boys. Men like James O. Eastland used words like that and the racist policies that accompanied them to perpetuate white supremacy and strip black Americans of our very humanity. Vice President Biden's relationships with proud segregationists are not the model for how we make America a safer and more inclusive place for black people." Anyway, he goes on to call, he directly calls for Biden to apologize. It was like a direct shot at Biden. Now, since then, they've sort of made up, not made up, that makes it sound like some like personal
feud. They had a call.
But they had a call, and apparently Booker sort of indicated now they're moving on. But the calculations behind Booker's statement, you know, I don't know if we want to get into that, because it's sort of hard to say. Maybe it just kind of felt strongly about the issue. Maybe it's about Biden has a majority of black support right now. That's a group that Booker needs to make inroads with.
And Booker has to, you know, so he did get a big increase in news coverage. So he was the fourth most covered candidate last week, which for Booker is high. He had been often, you know, sixth or seventh in some weeks. And so, you know, I think he's certainly, you know, well-positioned and very reasonable to make the statements that he did, and it was a well-phrased statement, so it could have been the right thing to do, quote-unquote, but like it's also like he's someone who has a very plausible rationale for being the nominee and who has kind of fallen into the background, and so, you know, to take opportunities like this, it is smart, tactically, I think, at least.
I agree, but it is interesting that, I mean, we talked a while ago about the fact that Harris and Booker both want to get some endorsements from congressional black caucus leaders, and it is perhaps interesting to note that most of them are, I think, behind Biden, but those couple who decided to maybe make a statement decided to endorse Harris, not Booker. I don't know what we're to make of that, but I mean, I think we probably are to make that she's higher in the polls than Cory Booker.
Yeah, and that if nothing else, that sort of ups the incentive for the Booker campaign to take some risks to try to make a splash.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the tension in the Democratic primary more broadly and whether it teaches us anything about the competing lanes. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Lightstream. Looking for a way to save some extra money this summer? Why not start by paying less interest on your credit card balances? Refinance with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. It's an easy way to save hundreds to thousands of dollars and lower your interest rate. Lightstream offers credit card consolidation loans from 5.9% APR with AutoPay. That's lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. There are absolutely no fees, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount, terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and we just talked a little bit about the conflict between Booker and Biden at the end of the week last week, but it seems that there's a larger trend perhaps emerging in the Democratic primary of conflict between candidates and potentially conflict within particular lanes, the progressive lane, you know, the lane that's trying to shore up support with African-American voters. You know, maybe there's some conflict within the moderate lane or the likable white guy lane like O'Rourke and Buttigieg or something like that. What are the trends that you've picked up, Claire, over the past, you know, week or so in how the candidates have been treating each other in the run up to the debates?
Well, I think the most interesting thing to watch has been the Sanders-Warren vibe. Shall I say?
Vibe.
Yeah.
What is that a euphemism for?
We have a youthful audience and we're just trying to speak their lingo. I think that Sanders and, well, we know now, it's been reported that Sanders and Warren had a non-aggression pact. Historically, those have worked out so well. But Sanders tweeted something pretty, Sanders' account, we should say, tweeted something that, you know, in response to a political article that said, you know, the Democratic establishment is now an everyone but Sanders movement. And it was an article about how Warren is becoming more seen as more acceptable by the political establishment. Now, we should note that Elizabeth Warren endorsed Hillary Clinton, has always, you know, has been a Democrat rather than an independent, as Sanders is, throughout her tenure in the U.S. Senate. So she is, by definition, and has always been more in with the establishment than Sanders. But this was seen as a pretty shot across the bow kind of tweet. And I would guess that some of that has to do with, yes, there's a debate coming up, but also the polls are perhaps tightening a little bit more. Warren, I think, has been nudging up a bit. And I mean, I guess maybe Nate will now talk about whether or not lanes exist. But I do think that because there are so many candidates, there is kind of natural like man on man picking, you know, maybe picking one person to kind of like lash out at a bit.
Right. And the title of the article that he retweeted, or the Politico tweet that accompanied the article, was "Centrists are coming around to Elizabeth Warren as an alternative to Bernie Sanders." So he retweeted that and then said, "The cat is out of the bag," or somebody from his account retweeted that and said, "The cat is out of the bag. The corporate wing of the Democratic Party is publicly, quote, anybody but Bernie." And then he went on to say more. But like,
well, read the rest of it because it's relevant context.
He said, "They know our progressive agenda of Medicare for all, breaking up big banks, taking on drug companies, and raising wages is the real threat to the billionaire class."
Which, as far as I know, Elizabeth Warren is in favor of all these things.
Right.
She literally has Bernie's health care plan, Medicare for all. You know, she's the one with the wealth tax that he doesn't have.
But he also then went on TV and was like, "No, that tweet was not about Elizabeth Warren. It was about the Democratic establishment, et cetera, et cetera." You know, just gotta get that in.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. And look, I doubt Bernie tweeted this. I think he has some people on his campaign that are pretty feisty on social media. and I think he probably was not happy with the person who tweeted that from his account.
Okay, that's conjecture. But here's some
non-conjecture. I think Sanders is making a mistake and has been mistaken for much of the campaign about doubling down on the Sanders anti-establishment base, which is just not enough on its own to win the primary. And I think he should instead be more of a, you know, a kinder, gentler Bernie who is saying, "Hey, look, my ideas are now at the forefront of the Democratic Party. Everyone's endorsed my health care plan. It's therefore natural that I, as someone who had so much support last time around, the person that they should back." So, you know, are there lanes? I mean, sort of halfway, right? The kind of halfway between, oh, people are just kind of not paying attention and or their views are really random, because if you go out and like talk to random voters, they'll be like, "Oh yeah, I'm either into Bernie or John Delaney or something," right? And it doesn't make any sense, but like that's how real voters
Maryland
are.
Maryland vote.
Yeah.
On the other hand, clearly Warren has taken some support from Sanders. If you kind of back up and look at where the polls now as opposed to 3 months ago, Warren is up 7 points and Sanders is down 7 points, and that's probably not a coincidence.
I think overall, also, we've seen more evidence for lanes develop over the past several weeks or whatever than there were originally, which is kind of what we expected.
What was our argument against lanes?
If you take polls, at least a few months ago, and you said, who's your second choice? It was pretty random, kind of, whose people's second choice was relative to their first choice.
Well, in fact, it wasn't just random. It was, we were looking at Biden, and his voters, the people who preferred Biden, their second choice was Sanders. And people who supported Sanders, their second choice was Biden. So it seemed like everything was based off of name recognition and not actually, like, a specific preference based on policy, style, agenda,
etc. So we should clarify, maybe, that this,
Let me clarify. Let me do some clarifying here. First of all, we... 538, we're never anti-lanes. The idea was simply that a very rigid view of lanes, where there's very little crossover between different types of voters, one is wrong. I don't think there's sort of like that bears true in the empirical record. But two, early on, there's just no evidence at that point that lanes had really developed, in the sense that there wasn't much sign in those second choice numbers that like that Bernie and Warren's support overlapped or whatever. Okay. Since then, one, as Nate mentioned, Bernie's support has gone down at the same time Warren's support has gone up. Now, is there a chance that's like purely coincidental? Sure, I guess there's a chance. But it's at least suggestive that they're drawing from the same pool. And two, Beto's support has gone down at the same time Buttigieg's support has gone up. Something we've talked about before, where it's like the, however you want to describe this lane. I said trendy, which Claire doesn't like.
Trendy? Like
it's like the trendy, that's too negative, but it's like.
It's the young
white moderates lane.
Yeah, that.
It's the khaki lane.
But the other thing is, if you look at those same second choice numbers, there's now more evidence of lanes. Like, if you look at Sanders supported, sure, Biden is still number one just because he's doing so well. But Warren performs disproportionately well among Sanders voters compared to everyone else.
So some of what we're saying is, caveat, not that most people aren't paying attention to the campaign, which I think is a thing we should say every once in a while to remind ourselves. A little mantra.
Although more than usually.
But also that as the campaign develops, as everyone is now pretty much in the race, we're looking at you, Sestak.
Yeah, what the f***?
And people are like nominally getting a sense of like, oh, who is this person? How are they differentiated? And like, do I like their personality more? Which is how a lot of people vote. That people are forming more nuanced opinions, and that more clear lanes will form as we go down the yellow brick road.
But even then, which we always expected that. You would expect that as voters learn more about the candidates, they'll sort more logically into these lanes. But even then, I think the point we were trying to make early on is that the lanes are like. Are like roads with dotted lines that people can cross over and cut over two lanes at once
Who would be the example of the pileup? I think Warren and Sanders are in a very distinct lane, policy-wise. But yeah. Then I do think, like, some of the other lanes, like as we've just described, you know, those O'Rourke and Buttigieg profess a lot of the same or profess similar ideas to a lot of the other candidates, but I think that their distinguishing lane is their identity, right?
Yeah.
Their idea of like...
Aging indie rock dad lane?
I'm a blue dot in a red state kind of vibe, and I'm white and young, and don't you like that? Okay. So yeah, so I'm saying a lot of it is, you know, political pheromones, personality, all that jazz, but I do think Warren and Sanders are in like a specific policy lane.
I mean, the problem, guys... is that there are...
Well, actually.
Actually. The lanes do cross into one another, you know, and they
it's
do
like... It's like the Autobahn.
It's like the freaking Autobahn. Oh, it's like New York City. Traffic in New York City at a three-way intersection or something.
In, like, the Village.
Yeah.
Let's be specific.
But, like, because on the one hand, voters can decide based on ideology. On the other hand, they can decide based on identity. And they can decide based on... hey, name recognition, or like, hey, I don't know.
Or who's hashtag winning at any moment in time.
Yeah.
So let me shake this up a little bit in terms of the Warren Sanders lane, because an article came out today from BuzzFeed News that talked to the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. And this is from Adam Green, the co-founder of the PCCC or whatever they call it. Quote, people think Warren's... quote, people think Warren's challenge is how to take a bunch of Bernie supporters. But, he goes on to say, the two big honeypots for Warren are actually Biden supporters and undecided voters, all of whom are electability voters and looking to go with somebody who can inspire voters in the general election. And so, you know, this is part of their launch of this, like, switch to Warren effort. The title of this article is, quote, these people are ready to bolt. Elizabeth Warren allies plan to target Joe Biden backers. So is this getting at, like, a different lane? What is that lane? Is electability voters a lane, or is this BS?
I would like a citation required on that. I read the article, and I didn't see any actual evidence behind his claim. But look, Biden is the biggest
block of voters
right now. He's 30%. And so you have to, like, you have to make some effort to play for that 30%, and maybe only 5% of that 30% is really gettable, but like 5% would be nice. But, you know, I mean, I still think she should be more concerned. I mean, I agree with the part about undecideds, but, you know, I still think even the diminished Bernie at 15%, I mean, you probably get into some point where, like, what we do an article the other week where it's like 8% of the electorate says they will only vote for Bernie Sanders and are not considering anyone else at the moment, right? So if it's down to 15%, then maybe you do get into diminishing returns now where the remaining Bernie voters are pretty hardcore. But, you know, that would still be the first,
I think,
the first scoop
Harrison
of
Warren
ice cream.
Well, that if
overlapping,
yeah,
support.
which is interesting. Among Warren supporters, Harris is the number one second choice at 22%.
Yeah,
so
that makes
she
sense.
Really outperforms there, and Warren outperforms a bit. She's the second choice among Harris supporters. But I do think the part of that article, or the idea in that article, that rings true, which I think Galen was getting at, is that electability, or just the desire to beat Trump, is going to span lanes and mush them together and pull voters across maybe divides that otherwise they wouldn't. For example, you know, there's some other reporting at like the Third Way conference over the weekend, where they talked to some people who were like at a Third Way conference, which is like
the centrist kind of like bipartisan, yeah, moderate
wet
group.
Dream. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were like,
earmuffs, children.
Sorry. and they were like, oh yeah, we'd be okay with Warren. We like that she has a plan for a lot of stuff. And
that's
and
what sparked this whole Bernie thing. Yeah.
No, I know. But I'm saying, I don't think that's like happening in some like wholesale way, but I do think it shows that the desire to beat Trump will make people sort of just like, be like, okay, I can get on that, on board that train. Too many metaphors here. It says a train on the Autobahn,
on a
and
lane.
There are lanes, and then the electability is like a overpass.
It's just a Mack truck driving down the lane.
Yeah, crisscrossing kind of.
And this is what we call a tortured metaphor.
Okay, so we were just talking about Booker and Biden, though. Do they share a lane? And what is that lane, if so?
Wants to appeal to black voters.
Yeah. And I think there might be like that age split of, I think, Mikey, you said this earlier, where Booker might be getting younger black voters who are kind of saying like, yikes to what Biden said.
Yeah.
Do we want to support that guy? And older black voters might tend to think, well, he's electable, so we should vote for him because we don't want Trump. I don't know. I mean, ostensible split.
I think that's a split in Biden support, where he does much better among older black voters. Booker isn't getting much of any support right now.
I mean, Booker is in the kind of at the crossroads where he's trying to be like Harris's. They're trying to be consensus choices, right? They're trying to bet on a scenario, which is not at all crazy, where voters say, you know what, Bernie and Warren are a bridge too far for me, but Biden is awfully old and makes a lot of missteps, right, and doesn't represent the new party. Therefore, what's a compromise, Harris or Booker? But that's hard. It's kind of a long game strategy. It does mean you're in a lot of cross traffic and competing for different types of voters. It does mean you can be a lot of people's second choices. Like Booker's favorability ratings are perfectly decent, but he's only the first choice of 2% of Democrats now or something. And so he doesn't have a particularly easy task, but he's someone who would hope to benefit as other candidates kind of eliminate themselves.
Can somebody, actually, a listener, please draw a diagram of all of the different lanes, trains, trucks, etc., and who they are and what exactly they represent in the Democratic primary?
I would love that. I would love to see that picture. I also, what is the best metaphor for a presidential election?
A mosh pit.
Is it a race? Is it a car race?
Car race is so much better than the horse race.
Car race is better than horse race?
No.
So much
horse races are very violent, actually. There's a lot of jostling.
No, car races are strategy and like
a lot of what?
Jostling.
Also, car races take a long freaking time. Horse races are over in like 2 minutes.
Yeah. That's true.
They just go around and around and
maybe
around.
Maybe it's an Ironman.
Yeah, maybe it's like one of those.
It's an Ironman.
Where
Iron
they
Man.
Go in the mudder, tough mudder.
Tough mudder.
Tough mudder.
I used to love watching the Ironman on TV.
Whatever it is, it definitely has to be something where by the end you're like, this needs to be over. So a horse
the
race
Tour
is
de France, yeah. Definitely.
The Tour de France.
I hate that's that. Good.
Yeah, okay, we'll go with it. Because a horse race, when it's over, you're like, wait, I missed it. Like, I just went to get a drink for a second and now it's
that's
over.
That's true. I would like to hear listener suggestions for this. What is the best metaphor for a presidential election?
But as we wrap this up and move on to our next topic, and please do let us know, as Micah asked, and also a diagram for all of our different metaphors throughout the podcast. But before we do move on, how do we expect all of this to play out at the debates? Claire, you said last week, it's not really going to be a debate. They're all going to have like 10 seconds to say whatever they want, and they just got to get that soundbite in. Does the week since then kind of like change your expectations at all for the kind of fireworks that might emerge?
No, I mean, listen, I think some candidates like Biden and Sanders will be taking more incoming fire. I feel like we're really going on like war metaphors today.
Now every metaphor is like, do I want to make this?
But I think that people like the second, third tier candidates are really going to try to get in the statement of purpose kind of thing. If they have an overarching media narrative that they maybe think is incorrect about them or not advantageous, I think the debate stage is a time when they're going to try to use that. So I'm pretty much sticking with my, this is not a debate, it's a soundbite fest.
It's almost,
which we will be live blogging.
If the candidates were driving down a highway, it's like the way station.
Micah.
It's the way station?
Yeah. You pull off, you get weighed, but there's not a lot of interaction, and you pull back on.
Isn't it like a toll booth where like people are cutting you off and you're shouting
out the worst metaphor I've ever.
We crossed the worst metaphor Rubicon long ago.
Okay. In that case, maybe it's time to move on.
Yes.
President Trump last week.
Who?
President Trump.
Said that we were on the brink of striking Iran when he called off the operation. So let's discuss what's going on there. But before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by WeWork. WeWork designs, builds, and operates workspaces for small, medium, and enterprise businesses in over 400 locations and 100 different cities around the world. WeWork and 538 have partnered to bring you The Way We Work Today, a series of articles that explores the best places to base your business in 2019. Economies and city dynamics vary from market to market, and we're taking a deep dive into which ones provide the best ecosystem for your business to flourish, of course while taking into consideration any downsides to be aware of. Factors such as the city's investment in economic development, tax incentives and rates, strength of workforce, cost of living, and public infrastructure are only a few key aspects that business owners need to consider when figuring out where to base their business headquarters and satellite locations. Head over to 538.com/WeWork to learn more about that series of articles. That's 538.com/WeWork. We're back, and on Friday morning, President Trump tweeted confirmation of reports that he had ordered military strikes against Iran and then called them off, citing potential casualties. This was after Iran reportedly shot down an unmanned American drone flying in international airspace. So, first of all, why did we find out about Trump calling off the airstrikes? Is this something that could have just happened and we never needed to find out about it? Why has this become such a public story?
Well, I think because it was a last minute thing. And so he had gotten far enough into the process of ordering the airstrikes. You know, once you've engaged that many parts of the government and the military, it's going to leak, I think. And also, like, the Trump administration has never been sort of that opaque. That's the right answer, right?
I mean, and then he also tweeted about it. You know, he talked about on Monday they shot down an unmanned drone flying in international waters. He said, we were cocked and loaded, not locked and loaded, to retaliate last night on three different sites when I asked, How many will die? 150 people, sir, was the answer from a general. 10 minutes before the strike, I stopped it. Not proportionate to shooting down an unmanned drone. I am in no hurry. Our military is rebuilt, new, and ready to go, by far the best in the world. Sanctions are biting, and more added last night. Iran can never have nuclear weapons, not against the USA and not against the world. What is he trying to tell people?
Well, let's back up. I think someone is obviously alarmed at the fact that someone convinced the president to take a strike at Iran. That is quite an escalation. I'm not sure I entirely take at face value the president's explanation, although perhaps it's true that he was only informed about casualties right before or in the midst of the strike, although I'm pretty sure that that's
a weird,
bad protocol.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think he is certainly trying to say, oh, I am cognizant of human life. I didn't want to kill people. But Iran should still be afraid because I might be willing to do this. But I thought it was in general like a very weird occurrence. I mean, it just the fact that it got so far and then it also leaked and then the president commented on it and continued to comment on it.
But there's always been this part of Trump for a candidate and a president who lies so much and for an administration which has sort of like obstructed investigations in a lot of ways,
yeah.
Even if you just look at like not responding to subpoenas and
sure.
stuff, there's also been this aspect to Trump of like hyper transparency, at least into like his own head in a weird way. I saw some people making the point, for example, that like you could totally imagine other presidents having ordered the strike and the gears start to turn later being like, oh, I don't want to do this, but not ordering it off because they knew it would leak and
sure.
they were afraid of looking
sure.
weak.
Yes, I think you're right that we have a pretty good insight into what Trump is thinking. To me, I'm also interested in the conversations that happened leading
yeah.
up to that and who, you know, what people were saying. John Bolton immediately comes to mind given his long vocal desire to eliminate the Iranian regime. And I would say if it got to this point, right, where they were in the midst of launching an attack, who's to say that it wouldn't happen again, right? That Trump is kind of like now entered this sort of new paradigm of taunting Iran almost, right? Like with this, but also saying, oh, but I'm not doing it. Yeah, we want to do sanctions. I believe he said we should enter into diplomatic arrangements with them and try to negotiate this, to which my immediate thought was, what treaty did the United States pull out of? But it was just an interesting series of transparent thoughts, as Micah has pointed out.
I think it's pretty smart
to not bomb.
I think it's good not to bomb stuff. No, I think, look.
Which part is smart? Narrow that down.
Ollie wrote a piece. Oliver Rader, 538 correspondent, wrote a piece about deterrence theory, and there's some game theory involved, right, where you want to be unpredictable. If your actions are easily readable, then in many contexts, including wartime, you're easy to out-strategize. I mean, I, you know, is there enough data at this point to say that Trump is not someone who wants a military conflict? I mean, maybe, you know, I don't know. He's been pretty forgiving, frankly, of North Korea, less so of Iran, and you can get into the reasons for that. But the problem with being too peaceful is that you're vulnerable to attack. So maybe if he kind of defaults toward, on the one hand, being fairly peaceful, or at least not wanting to involve American troops abroad, and on the other hand, being unpredictable enough that he can be a deterrent.
You're saying the effect of the last minute switch might be good in the sense of sowing unpredictability in the minds of America's geopolitical rivals.
Right.
Not that Trump sort of planned this, because I would that seems a bridge too far to me.
I mean, they were out with the story pretty quickly, right? There was like a lot of denial over it. It could be that Bolton whatever wants to embarrass Trump or something.
Yeah.
But
as with past stories, of course, though, Trump could have said, that's a lie. I never ordered this airstrike. And it wouldn't have been all that different from past denials, right? He very quickly and clearly said, this is all true. This is exactly what I did.
Mind,
this is why I did it. To kind of like simplify a theme that Nate was getting to, and maybe this is too simple of a question to answer, but is Trump a dove or a hawk? What is the supporting evidence on either side?
I'm not sure we know the answer to that question. Well, I think it's too simplified of a question in the sense of that I don't think Trump has an overarching philosophy of international engagement that guides his actions in the way that Bush did or in the way that Clinton did.
So America First is not that overarching principle that guides his actions with tariffs, with isolationism.
Well,
with-
he did reach a point where he supposedly the trigger for his airstrikes against Syria was that he saw images of people who had been gassed.
Which is not America First.
Which is not America First. It's a very sort of capricious, idiosyncratic.
It's kind of the Clinton humanitarian intervention doctrine, whatever. I don't think Trump has like an overarching philosophy that kind of undergirds these actions. I think he's reacting on an ad hoc basis, which shows in a case like this. The harder question to answer is, was Trump perceived as a dove or a hawk in 2016? And did that matter to people who supported him? During the Republican primary, Trump was rated by voters as more moderate than the other candidates or many of the other candidates, and more moderate than you would think based on his positions on immigration, for example. And the reason I think is stuff like this, of where he railed against Bush's, quote, foreign adventurism, you know, that kind of stuff, or where he broke from the party on, like, Social Security and stuff like that. And so I guess I do wonder for, like, the Obama-Trump voters.
Yeah. He was weirdly, like, non-interventionist, right, during the campaign. I think that was kind of a line he had. But also, like, a hawk domestically, if we can say that, right? Like, immigration-wise, it was, we need to focus on the United States. But part of focusing on the United States was having these crackdown policies, these active policies, not passive. Well, this is generally our philosophy. It was no Muslims allowed into the United States. It's almost like hawkishness transferred onto the domestic policy agenda.
But just if you look at what Trump has done policy-wise, especially legislation, it's mostly been normal Republican stuff.
Yeah.
And if you look at polls, voters now call Trump more likely to call Trump conservative than they used to be, as opposed to moderate, right? And so I wonder if going into 2020, sort of he's treated as more of a normal Republican, and people like the Obama-Trump voters sort of abandon him, maybe. We're seeing some of that in the polls. Or if stuff like this forestalls that to some extent, because he makes these high-profile decisions not to retaliate or not to get involved in conflicts abroad.
It sounded like you were suggesting that maybe a more isolationist, dovish, non-interventionist, at least, approach is potentially a tenet of the Trump Republican Party. Do you think that just people were like, okay, well, he said this and I like him, so I'm going to go along for the ride, as they did with views on Russia or views on tariffs? Is there a strong feeling of we need to be non-interventionist within the Republican Party that would actually be quite upset from any kind of intervention in Iran? Or is it just, I'll go with what the president says because I like the guy?
I don't know is the honest answer.
I think a conflict with Iran is something that Republicans do not want to do. I think the party still has a hangover from the Bush legacy of intervention. I mean, Bush kind of tramped all over the idea of fiscal conservatism with those wars, but also the idea that the U.S. could potentially be at odds with both Iran and North Korea at the same time. I mean, those are the two sort of countries on our horizon right now when it comes to foreign policy. I'm guessing that makes a lot of people in the Republican establishment very nervous.
What do we know about how the electorate feels about potential conflict?
There's not a lot of good polling on it, to be honest, Galen.
That sounded like you were confessing to a crime or something.
Obviously, the legacy of the Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly Iraq conflicts, has, I think, profoundly for the long-term affected public views on kind of Bush-style interventionist foreign policy. I think there's some level on which Trump has a pitch that is, hey, look, I provide you with peace and prosperity, and everything else is fake news. That is a harder pitch to make if we're in a kind of hot war against Iran or anyone, really, apart from the wars that he's trying to wind down. So, no, there's not like a ton of polling. I mean, there is polling that says, like, if Iran were to strike us first, then there would be support for a retaliation. They did strike on this drone, I guess, right? But I think he's probably right that I think politically there are more risks. I don't know, because, you know, you can make the kind of wag the dog argument, and boy, he's really unpopular, and people kind of have a rally around the flag effect and whatever else, and like, yeah, if there were to be some country that were to, like, run a big terrorist attack on the United States, on U.S. soil in particular, then I think it would be popular to obviously retaliate. But the notion of like kind of having a war half the world away in the Middle East again, I don't think that would be popular, or at least I think there's more downside risk than upside risk for Trump, although you can argue that like he's in a not great position, so he can afford to take a more risk-filled portfolio. But I think Harris' instincts are probably right.
We should also say that short of war, foreign policy tends to not have a huge influence on elections.
And when you do poll about just, you know, how do people feel about how Trump is handling our relationship with Iran in general, it honestly tracks pretty close to what his approval
overall,
rating is
yeah.
overall. In a Reuters Ipsos poll in May, so before all this happened, it was 49% of Americans disapproved, 39% approved. But in any case, I am getting word from Tony in the control room that he wants to go watch the Women's World Cup soccer game. So I think that actually means we have to wrap things up. But thanks so much, you guys. And we're, of course, going to be back later this week to cover the both of the debates. We're going to have reaction pods both nights. So listeners, look in your feeds for that.
Are they two debates or is it one debate over two nights?
Great
it
question.
It is two debates because the people can't talk to each other over different nights. Or at least they can't respond to each other.
It's not a good question.
I think it's one
debate.
It's one debate.
This is like peak Nate, I want to start a fight.
Readers, weigh in.
Master debater Nate Silver just wants to get in some punches.
In any case, thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Okay, draw a picture of all the metaphor stuff. What is the best metaphor for a presidential election? And are the debates this week two or one debate?
That's a lot of homework.
That is, yeah. But get back to us.
All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.